Program originally scheduled for this time will not be heard. The Associated Press at the war fronts. In 1,400 newspapers from coast to coast, you read stories with a famous symbol AP after each dateline. The symbol means that an Associated Press representative was there to report the event for member newspapers. Tonight, the National Broadcasting Company is privileged to bring you from the troubled spots of the world the voices of American-trained AP war correspondents. But first, here is Oliver Gramling, executive assistant to the general manager of the Associated Press. He will tell you about the men whose voices will come to you from Geneva, Madrid, Shanghai, and Tokyo. Mr. Gramling.
A worldwide staff of several thousand men gather the news that your Associated Press member newspaper prints daily for your information. It is a staff bound to the ideals of truthful, unbiased reporting on which the Associated Press was founded as a cooperative, nonprofit association many years ago. Day in and day out, night in and night out, in all countries, under all conditions, these men are at work. This program is not to bring you the latest news from the war fronts. That news, minutes old, is being printed by your Associated Press member newspaper, even as I speak. But as another service of your newspaper to its reader, we are bringing you the voices of faraway correspondents so that you may know how they live, some of their personal experiences, some of the things they are doing. From Geneva, Joseph Sharkey will speak. He is a native of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and has been an AP man for 40 years. He has reported international war conferences for the past 15. Next, from Madrid, Charles Nutter, a native of Fall City, Nebraska. His last 10 years have been divided between Mexico, London, Russia, and now warring Spain. From Shanghai, center of the current Sino-Jap conflict, Maurice Harris. He comes from Columbia, Missouri. He has covered the sore spots of the world for 10 years. At Harris' side will be Jim Mills, dean of AP's foreign reporters. He is a native of New York, but a roving citizen of the world. When Gandhi emerged from a jail in an obscure town in India a few years ago, he found Jim Mills waiting to see him. The thin little fellow wrapped his sheet about his shrunken body and rocked with laughter. Gandhi looked at Mills and said, "When I stand at the gates of heaven, I suppose the first person I'll see will be a correspondent of the Associated Press." Last, from Tokyo, Relman Marin. He is a native of Freeport, Illinois, but he is a long way from home now. These men have just sent their latest stories to the AP, and this is their breathing spell. And now for Joseph Sharkey, we take you to Geneva, Switzerland.
Hello, NBC. Hello, America. This is Geneva calling. Your speaker is Joseph E. Sharkey, the correspondent of the Associated Press at Geneva. This ancient and beautiful city, which houses over 50 international organizations, beginning with the League of Nations, all dedicated to international cooperation and concord, has focused world attention more than ever before because of tragic world events. A sanguinary war in the Far East, a desperate civil strife in Spain, which threatens to cause international complications, and piracy in the Mediterranean. All have come to Geneva as the place where nations bring their troubles. Throughout a long Associated Press career, of which 8 years were spent in Japan and the Far East, I have never observed more swiftly dramatic events than have taken place here within the past 3 weeks. The atmosphere has been charged with political passion, but simultaneously with a consuming determination to do something effective to slay the specter of more wars and of worse wars. That explains the rapid-fire nine-power conference held in the neighboring town of Nyon to destroy modern Mediterranean piracy, a conference which broke all world conference records in its businesslike brevity. Italy and Germany declined to come, but in later conversations, Mussolini agreed to have his country participate in the patrol of the Mediterranean to annihilate pirates, whether they be submarines, surface warships, or airplanes. But the most sensational development at the League of Nations was the solemn condemnation of Japan for its bombing of open towns in China, with the slaying of great numbers of women and children. As cabled to the Associated Press, the resolution adopted voices profound distress at the loss of life caused to innocent civilians and declares that no excuse can be found for such acts which have aroused horror and indignation throughout the world. This resolution was adopted first by an advisory committee of 23 states, upon which the United States Minister, Mr. Leland Harrison, sat as an observer, but without the right to vote, and then solemnly approved by the League Assembly, attended this year by 52 nations. The unequivocal speeches made were generally interpreted as voicing the apprehension that if such air bombardment is tolerated in Eastern Asia, it would create a terrifying precedent as to what might happen in Europe should that war come which statesmen are seeking desperately, but with increasing hopefulness, to ward off. Today, Wellington Koo, China's foremost diplomat, asked the League to declare that China is the victim of Japanese aggression. Two important United States initiatives attracted general attention. The first was Minister Harrison's presentation to the League of Secretary of State Hull's statement at Washington, commenting upon the League's anti-bombing resolution. This statement was interpreted here as an approval of the League's action, and its reading was greeted with applause. The second United States initiative was the official transmission to the League Council of Secretary Hull's declaration of the principles which guide the United States in its international relations. America's powerful peace credo was how one statesman characterized it to me. Whilst the League was condemning Japan, another League committee, upon which Mr. Howard Bucknell Jr., the United States consul, sat as an observer, began a study of what could be done to help China in a humanitarian way. Valencia, Spain's accusations against Italy and Germany of aggressive armed intervention in Spain caused a long and sometimes bitter debate, which was all the more dramatic because at that very moment, Mussolini and Hitler, meeting in Germany, were strengthening the rapprochement between Italy and Germany and giving new power to what is known as the Rome-Berlin political axis. At Geneva, England and France fought doggedly to avoid the passage of a resolution so drastic in form that it would make impossible negotiations with Mussolini for the withdrawal from Spain of the Italian forces. The leaders believe they succeeded, for Italy, Germany, and Russia are not mentioned. But, as cabled to the Associated Press, the resolution adopted declares that there exist on Spanish soil veritable foreign army corps, urges their immediate withdrawal, and warns that if this be not done quickly, the powers will be entitled to scrap the policy of non-intervention. No sketch of the Geneva sessions would be complete without referring to the influential role of representatives of 40 million world women. They have had the League set up an organization to secure a wider opportunity for women in world activities. But in a larger sphere, women leaders have labored unceasingly here for the strengthening of the sinews of peace. Anxiety crowned with hope marked this thrilling period. The ultimate goal of Geneva was described by leaders to be that of a world forum to discuss and, if possible, heal the world's woes, to promote friendship between all nations, yet with a practical recognition also that the most pacific nations are justified these days in arming for self-defense. Also because their armed strength will help them to speak of peace with authority. And finally, breathing through it all, the wisdom of all nations following the heavenly message, peace on earth, goodwill towards men. We take you now to Madrid, Spain.
Midnight skirmish is underway in heavy rain. Mines roar, hand grenades crash, and machine guns spit forth their messages of death, all for a few yards of ground which will have no bearing on the outcome of the war. Occasionally, nationalist guns stationed at Garabitos raise their elevation, and the thin whine of heavy shells soaring over the city is heard, followed by explosions. Tomorrow, Madrid will count a few more maimed or dead. And so this war that seems to have no finish drags on. But tonight, a million persons, indifferent to the noise and danger of conflict, sleep huddled together in the safest rooms their homes afford. A people determined never to leave their capital. They face a second cold winter with no heat, food very short, and danger of sudden death always present. They have been told to surrender their gold and jewels and excess bed clothing to the government for war purposes. All have lost relatives and expect to lose more. A quarter of their city has been blasted into ruins, but they will not evacuate. Civilian Madrid is no longer a city afraid. Scarcely anything that could happen would be worse than the first disastrous months of the war. The terrifying days of last November, when troops were battling all over the western streets, are gone, and military authorities say they will not return. With great effort, General Miaja has driven back the invaders, except in ruined University City, to less dangerous ground. The Republicans are entrenched in positions from which it appears they never will be driven. Madrid is protected by hundreds of impregnable barricades around which laughing children, indifferent to death a mile away, noisily play at war. Their mothers sit knitting on nearby, while down the street their fathers drink barley and try to imagine it is coffee. Cigarettes are all at the front, so they do not smoke. Soldiers wander by. Suddenly, nearby, a hidden Republican gun roars. The children creep joyously at this realistic touch, but adults scarcely glance up. War's upsetting clash has become an almost unconscious part of their daily life. Along Madrid's Broadway, the Gran Via, where danger is most acute, the streets are filled with theatergoers. War, adventure, and comedy films are favored. The Marx Brothers are playing their fifth week at the Capitol Theater, which has been hit 20 times. Nearby is the American-built telephone building, in which, miraculously, no one has been hurt, although it has been hit by 118 shells. There are 37 movie houses and 18 legitimate theaters open here, all playing to packed houses. The last show is over at 9 o'clock, and most everyone in bed by 9:30. Once the gayest city in Europe, Madrid is a ghost city now, after dark. All lights are out, and late-goers need flashlights to pick their way down inky black streets. The sound of a train whistle has not been heard here in nearly a year. Every railway is cut, as well as six of Madrid's seven main highways. New American trucks and Spanish mule carts keep the city alive. There is no easy key to understanding of this bitter conflict, which involves international, economic, religious, labor, class, and racial issues in almost inexplicable confusion. The front line, which winds unevenly for 1,500 miles south across eastern Spain, with a horseshoe curve at its center around Madrid, is no natural geographical division of the forces at war. In a recent summary for the Associated Press, I pointed out the government is stronger now than ever before, although holding considerably less than half of territorial Spain.
We take you now to Shanghai, China.
Hello, America. This is George Checklin speaking to you from Shanghai, China. To our studio somewhere in the outer perimeter of Shanghai, we have brought to you this morning Mr. Morris J. Harris, the Chief of Bureau, the Associated Press, Shanghai, who is directing the news service of that great institution in the present emergency. Mr. Harris, referral to Shanghai Sino-Japanese hostilities of 1932. Mr. Harris.
Passing through the most severe crisis it has experienced in years is increasingly apparent as the present emergency unfolds. Particularly is this true as regards Americans and other foreigners and their interests here. Far-flung severe fighting has engulfed in chaos and suffering China's largest and leading cities, wherein live a great proportion of the foreigners in this country. The trouble started near Peiping, as reported by the Associated Press at the time. In the ancient capital, with its foreign colony, immediately faced a grave emergency. The Americans and others fled to the embassy quarter, while American Marines, British Tommies, and other foreign troops manned the walls, which had not seen such a show since Boxer days. J.D. Hunt of the Associated Press vividly described this latest Peiping siege. Tintin got its deluge of fire later, which AP's Yates McDaniel reported to the world in graphic dispatches from the battle zone. Japanese artillery and air bombers quickly crushed Chinese opposition, simultaneously destroying a large portion of the city. Here again, the large foreign colony was directly involved. They came through with but few fatalities, but spent many anxious days. The American 15th Infantry, in Tintin since Boxer times, played an important part in the defense of the foreign areas. In Shanghai and Nanking have come the most serious dangers to foreigners. As the Associated Press has related in thousands of dispatches in recent weeks, in Peiping and Tintin, foreigners were spared the acutely dangerous close-range air raids which have been almost daily occurrences here and in Nanking, the latest being here early today. Shanghai, with its more than 50,000 foreigners, has become an aerial battleground as well as the scene of two powerful armies distant what this appears to be a deadlock. Canton is also an aerial battleground with great danger to civilians. The question is asked, how does the present emergency compare with that of 1932, when the Japanese again invaded Shanghai, destroying Chapay and other portions of the city? The introduction of aerial warfare this time has made the present emergency far more serious than in 1932. This is true for both foreigners and Chinese. The fighting started here with both China and Japan sending their air fleets into combat directly over Shanghai, and mostly over the foreign areas. This plunged foreigners into the greatest dangers they have yet faced in this eternally anxious city. The now famous bombings of August 14th, in which projectiles fell in Nanking Road, Frenchtown, and elsewhere, illustrate the point. With hostile air fleets operating overhead, both belligerents repeatedly turned their anti-aircraft fire over the city, spraying shrapnel and shell fragments widely. Only in rare instances did this occur in 1932. Artillery shells have found their way into the settlements in larger numbers than before. More foreigners have been killed or wounded. destruction of foreign property has been greater, resulting from artillery fire, aerial bombing, and the resultant fires. Pochong, Yangtze Po, Hangqiu, Chapei, Changwon, as well as isolated areas, have been laid waste. Thousands of foreigners lived in those areas when the fighting began. Most of them got out. The property loss is tremendous. Nanjing was shelled by the Japanese fleet in 1932 when their Marines went into Chapei here. The damage to Nanjing was slight. There was no aerial bombing then. This time, the Chinese stymied the Japanese fleet with a blockade in the Yangtze River below Nanjing, between Nanjing and the sea. The Japanese took to the air, and the incessant air raids of the Chinese capital are the result. Foreigners and Chinese alike in Nanjing have never before faced the dangers that now exist. What the result is going to be, no one knows. The Chinese say they are prepared for a long war and intend to resist as long as there are Japanese troops in China. Chan replies, China's resistance must be broken. Their attacks are to continue until this is achieved. The prospects seem to point to months more of war, spread over virtually the whole of China and possibly beyond. You have just listened to a talk by Mr. Morris J. Harris. Also in the studio with us this morning is Mr. James A. Mills, veteran staff correspondent of the Associated Press, who has been covering war since the Great World Conflict of 1914, and who reported the recent war in Abyssinia. Mr. Mills will tell you of China's unknown source. Mr. Mills. Standing by my side, wounded and fresh from the fighting line at the Charles Chapay, is China's unknown soldier. Most other nations have their own unknown warriors, but China has none. Or rather, it would be more correct to say that China has untold millions of unknown soldiers. For this is a land of forgotten men. Among China's 400 million, this wounded soldier at my side represents an emblem of the new China, a resurgent, united, strong, progressive China. The Chinese say this China is fighting a mighty empire which would rob the Chinese Republic of that unity, strength, and progress which she has gained since the fall of the Dragon Throne in Peking. I have been asked to translate to you the story of this unknown soldier's life in order to acquaint you with the sacrifices and suffering he and his country are enduring to retain their liberty and their fatherland. I was born to poverty, this unknown soldier says. I was reared in adversity, sorrow, and suffering. I have survived all the storms and stresses of life in a country formerly scourged with civil war, revolution, floods, famines, and plagues. I tilled the soil of China's good earth until my shoulders stooped and my hands fled. Filial duty required me to remain with my aged parents until they died. I was then taken from my village to serve in the army of my provincial governor, to fight my brother across the frontier in another province. For days, I went without food, sleep, or shelter. Against my will, I was forced to slay my own kinsmen in a neighboring province. Then a great man, General Chiang Kai-shek, arose in China like Lincoln in America. He said, "Let there be no strife. Let us all unite like brothers. We are all sons of the same family. We are the same blood and destined to share a common fate. Let us resolve to make a new and greater China. Let us forget the tragic past in the realization of a brighter future. We must unite against the designs and aggressions of a powerful enemy." It was then that I joined Chiang Kai-shek's army. From a hamlet in a remote province, I was sent to Nanjing. Here I was trained as a soldier. Then the Japanese came and took away Pekin, Shenzhen, and other parts of our good earth in the north. Then they tried to take Shanghai. It was then that the whole of China rose as one man and decided to fight to the last to expel the invaders. With my comrade, I was ordered to the Shanghai front. We marched 30 miles daily over roads constantly bombed by the enemy. Finally, we reached the front line. For long days and nights, we lived in trenches a foot deep in water. We went for days without food, water, sleep, or rest. We were bombed and shelled remorselessly by enemy airplanes, naval guns, and artillery. Against the steel and dynamite of our powerful adversaries, we had little more than our courage and the most inadequate weapons. Unlike your American soldiers in France, who had every comfort, we had to fight the enemy in the knowledge that if we were wounded, we would have no regular hospital to go to, no smiling doctor to bind our wounds, no sympathetic nurse to comfort us in our pain, no home to go to if we recovered, nobody to bury us if we died. You saw hundreds of my comrades killed in battle, thousands of others wounded, countless others perish of disease and exposure. But all this death and suffering only gave me greater courage. I decided I must avenge my comrade's death and the honor of my country. I took part in the bitter fighting yesterday at Beppei when the Japanese tried to take away from us that great military shrine to the memory of the famous 19th Swiss Army defenders. After shooting off all my bullets, I seized my sword and slashed it right and left against the enemy. I had already tasted blood and wanted more. A hurricane of bullets, bombs, and hand grenades exploded all around me, making the place a veritable hell. Suddenly, I felt blood trickling from my arm. I knew...
We take you now to Tokyo.
Mr. Roman Morin, an Associated Press correspondent, who will present a reportorial talk on the present situation in the Far East. Mr. Morin.
Hello, America. This is Tokyo, the capital of the Japanese Empire. You are now at the very nerve center of a nation which is performing the unusual feat of being at peace with China officially and at war with China actually, all at the same time. It's a situation that completely contradicts itself. And the whole appearance of Japan this morning will be even more surprising as you see it through the eyes of the Associated Press. Outwardly, there is not the slightest sign of war fever, either in Tokyo or in the surrounding countryside. Only a few weeks ago, we were cabling thousands of words about the troops departing, the excited crowds waving the red rising sun flags of Japan, the throngs on the docks at Yokohama calling Banzai, the ships sailing under sealed orders, the glittering swords and the martial music. But today, the ballyhoo of war has gone. In its place, there is a deadly calm, all the more oppressive because it boils up from beneath the surface. Japan is gripped today by a grim, deep-seated determination to liquidate, once and for all time, a condition in China that she considers to be intolerable. Quite recently, a diplomat in the Japanese Foreign Office told the Associated Press, and I am now quoting, "We didn't begin this war. We didn't want it, and neither did the Chinese nation. Both Japan and China are..."
For the past half hour, the National Broadcasting Company has brought you the first interview direct from the war fronts of the world by Associated Press correspondents. From New York, you heard O.S. Gramling, executive assistant to the general manager of the Associated Press. From Geneva, Switzerland, you heard Joseph Sharkey. From Madrid, Spain, correspondent Charles P. Nutter. From Shanghai, China, Associated Press correspondents Morris Harris and James T. Mills brought you the story of the Sino-Japanese situation. And from Tokyo, Associated Press correspondent Relman Morin reported the events in Japan. The Associated Press correspondents heard on this coast-to-coast broadcast are the reporters whose stories you read in your newspapers that carry the Associated Press service. This broadcast was arranged in cooperation with the Associated Press and came to you through the facilities of RCA Communications Incorporated. This is the National Broadcasting Company.